TQ Love right here on VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak, Katie Weaver, Dan Friedel, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
The world's top tennis player, Novak Djokovic, has been denied entry to Australia over an issue with his visa. The Australian Border Force said in a statement on Thursday, the ABF can confirm that Mr. Djokovic failed to provide appropriate evidence to meet the entry requirements to Australia, and his visa has been subsequently cancelled. Djokovic's lawyers told Australian media that Djokovic would fight the decision. Djokovic arrived in Melbourne, Australia, at about 11:30 local time on Wednesday evening to compete in the Australian Open tournament. Djokovic had said earlier on Tuesday that he received a medical exemption from Australia's vaccine requirement. However, his team applied for a visa that does not permit entry for medical exemptions. Djokovic's father told Serbian media that his son was kept waiting alone in a room at the airport. He said there were armed guards outside while his son was waiting for a decision on whether he could enter the country. Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić wrote on Twitter that he spoke with Djokovic on the phone. He said, "I told our Novak that the whole of Serbia is with him and that our bodies are doing everything to see that the harassment of the world's best tennis player is brought to an end immediately." The local government of Victoria, the state where the Open is played, said it would not support Djokovic's application. The decision rested with the federal government and Prime Minister Scott Morrison. Morrison had already suggested Djokovic may not be approved to play in the tournament. Morrison said he would need approval from the federal government, which has responsibility for international borders and visas. Morrison said earlier there would be no special rules for Djokovic on his exemption. If that evidence is insufficient, then he won't be treated any different to anyone else, and he'll be on the next plane home, Morrison told reporters. The Australian Open starts on January 17th. The tournament is one of the four major tennis tournaments in the world, known as the Grand Slam. Djokovic has won the last three played at the Melbourne Park Tennis Center. He is now trying to win a record 21 Grand Slam titles to pass Rafael Nadal and Roger Federer. The tournament organizer, Tennis Australia, requires everyone at Melbourne Park to be vaccinated or have an exemption given by a group of medical experts. Djokovic's announcement that he had received a medical exemption to play angered many Australians. In total, the country has spent the longest time in lockdown in the world. There are a record number of cases in Australia now because of the Omicron variant of the virus. Australia has one of the world's strictest visa policies when it comes to COVID-19 vaccines. Djokovic has never said whether he has or will receive a COVID-19 vaccine, but applying for the exemption would suggest that he has not. Tennis Australia and government officials said Djokovic, who has said he is opposed to COVID-19 vaccinations, had received no special treatment. Rod Laver is a famous former Australian tennis player. He told News Corp that many Australians might think, "Yes, I'd love to see him play and compete, but at the same time, there's a right way and a wrong way." Yes, you're a great player, and you've performed and won so many tournaments, so it can't be physical. So what is the problem? With the exemption, Djokovic will not be required to quarantine. He will have the same freedoms in Melbourne as someone who is vaccinated. I'm Dan Novak.
Taiwanese military airplanes took part in a war training exercise Wednesday. The flights were part of a three-day training event to demonstrate Taiwan's battle readiness before the Lunar New Year holiday at the end of January. Before takeoff, flight crews at a base in the southern city of Jiayi hurried to prepare aircraft as an alarm sounded. Pilots from our wing are very experienced and have dealt with almost all types of their aircraft, Major Yen Shin Chen told reporters. The officer also talked about an incident late last year in which he was deployed to intercept Chinese fighter planes. Tensions between mainland China and Taiwan have been rising in the past few years. China considers the island a rebel province, and it has not ruled out using force to control Taiwan. Chinese military aircraft often fly into the southwestern part of Taiwan's air defense identification zone. Taiwan has protested the flights. Taiwan has termed China's activities as gray zone warfare. It says China is trying to tire Taiwan's forces by making them repeatedly react to aggressive action. Taiwan's national defense spokesman said the island's armed forces were reinforcing their defense capabilities for the country's security. In a New Year message for China last week, Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen said military conflict is not the answer. China answered with a strong warning. It said if Taiwan crossed any red line, it would lead to a profound catastrophe. I'm Katie Weaver.
Fatima Madrigal of California recently gave birth to a boy and a girl. However, the twins have different birth dates and even birth years. Alfredo Antonio Trujillo was born on December 31st, 2021, at 11:45 p.m. About 15 minutes later, his sister Eileen was born on January 1st, 2022. Fatima said her family, which includes her partner Robert Trujillo and their three other children, were happy to welcome the new babies. The babies were supposed to come 2 weeks later, but their early arrival created a rare set of birth dates and years. Eileen weighed 2.66 kilograms and her brother weighed 2.75 kilograms. It was a surprise, Fatima said. I was kind of shocked because twins don't run in my family. Fatima went on to say her family is now complete. When they are older, Fatima said she would tell the children the story of their birth and permit them to choose if they wanted to celebrate their birthdays separately or together. But right now that they're small and they're with me, she said, they're going to celebrate their birthday together. The medical center where the twins were born said there are about 120,000 twins born each year in the U.S. However, twins with different birthdays are rare, and the chance of twins being born in different years is about 1 in 2 million. I'm Dan Friedel.
BlackBerry recently confirmed that as of January 4th, 2022, it will no longer support the operating system for its once popular devices. In its end-of-life announcement, the Canadian-based company said older BlackBerry devices would no longer work effectively for phone calls or data services. The company did note that some BlackBerry devices using the Android operating system will still work. These include models launched from 2015 to 2018, starting with the BlackBerry Priv to the BlackBerry Evolve X. The decision to end BlackBerry support was first made public in September 2020. That is when company chief John Chen announced that BlackBerry had officially moved from being a device manufacturer to a software developer. The company, Chen said, was now centered on providing security software and services to enterprises and governments around the world. That decision followed years of struggles by the company to keep selling BlackBerry devices as competition intensified in the worldwide smartphone market. At the height of its popularity, the BlackBerry, with its built-in keyboard, enjoyed a huge market share of the mobile phone market. The BlackBerry began to rise in 1999, 8 years before Apple launched its first iPhone. At the time, the new BlackBerry 850 offered email, wireless data, and a traditional keyboard. Demand for the new combination devices started to expand. They became especially popular with business people and government officials. BlackBerry kept adding services and launching new devices through the early 2000s. By 2010, the devices held a market share of more than 40%, Internet data company Comscore reported at the time. The company was the leader in the smartphone market above Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Palm. The ability of the BlackBerry to keep people connected at all hours even led to the term CrackBerry. The term was used to describe the dependence and addictive nature of the devices for many individuals. But over the next several years, BlackBerry began to experience major drops in sales. It was forced to repeatedly delay new product launches. By 2016, Comscore reported that BlackBerry's market share had shrunk to just 1%. At the time, Android-based phones had a share of about 53%, while Apple held 43%. The smartphones offered by Android and Apple appealed to many users who favored the touchscreen designs and an unlimited number of apps. The huge fall in popularity was noted in 2016 by one of the biggest fans of the BlackBerry, then-President Barack Obama. He pushed for the ability to keep his BlackBerry in the White House after his 2008 election. During his presidency, Obama spoke openly about his dependence on his BlackBerry device. While speaking with American talk show host Jimmy Fallon in June 2016, Obama said, "I was this cool, high-tech guy when I got in the White House, and I was the first president to have a BlackBerry." But he then added, "So years pass, and no one else has BlackBerries." Obama admitted that although he still loved the device and wanted to keep carrying it, he was advised to give it up for a new smartphone. In recent years, Chinese electronics company TCL entered a partnership with BlackBerry that permitted it to manufacture and sell the latest BlackBerry-licensed devices. Those devices use the Android operating system. In early 2020, an American startup company called Onward Mobility announced a plan to launch a 5G BlackBerry device powered by Android. The company's website states that the new BlackBerry 5G smartphones were expected to be available in 2021. The website provides no other details, but offers interested parties the chance to sign up to stay informed. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The Spanish-American War took place in the late 1800s during the administration of President William McKinley. On December 10, 1898, the United States and Spain signed a treaty in Paris, officially ending the war between them. However, the fighting had stopped much earlier. Spain had made the first move toward peace after its forces surrendered at Santiago on the Cuban coast. A few weeks before that, the United States Navy had destroyed Spain's Atlantic fleet. The American naval victory ended any chance that Spain could win the war. Doug Johnson and Steve Ember continue the story of President William McKinley and the Spanish-American War.
Late in July, the French ambassador in Washington gave President William McKinley a message from the Spanish government. Spain asked what terms the United States would demand for peace. President McKinley sent an immediate answer. Spain, he said, must give up Cuba. It must also give to the United States the islands of Puerto Rico and Guam. And he said Spain must recognize the right of the United States to occupy Manila in the Philippines. The future of the Philippines, he said, would be decided during negotiations on a peace treaty.
McKinley's terms seemed severe to Spain, but Spain had no choice. It could not continue the war. So, 10 weeks after war broke out, Spain agreed to stop the fighting and accept the American terms. It signed a peace agreement in Washington on August 12th. A Spanish note protested sadly that the agreement took away the last memory of a glorious past. It expels us from the Western Hemisphere, which became peopled and civilized through the proud efforts of our fathers.
The two countries agreed to meet in Paris to negotiate details of a peace treaty. The talks opened October 1st. The two sides agreed quickly on the issue of Cuban independence and an American takeover of Puerto Rico and Guam. But they could not agree on what to do about the Philippines. At the beginning of the talks, the United States was not sure if it wanted all or only part of the Philippines. At first, President McKinley wanted Spain to give up only Luzon, the main island. Then he decided that the United States should demand all of the Philippines. McKinley explained later how he made this decision.
I thought first we would take only Manila, then Luzon, then other islands perhaps. I walked the floor of the White House many nights. More than once I went down on my knees and asked God to help me decide. And one night, said McKinley, it came to me this way, that we could not give the Philippines back to Spain. That would be cowardly and dishonorable. We could not turn them over to France or Germany, our trading competitors in Asia. That would be bad business. We could not leave them to themselves. They were not ready for self-government. So there was nothing for us to do but to take them all, and to educate the Filipinos, to civilize them, and make Christians of them. With that decision, said McKinley, I went to bed and slept well.
Spain, however, did not want to give up the Philippines. It protested that the United States had no right to demand the islands. True, Americans occupied Manila, but they did not control any other part of the Philippines. The two sides negotiated for days. Finally, they reached an agreement. Spain would give all of the Philippines to the United States. In return, the United States would pay Spain $20 million. With this dispute ended, the peace treaty was quickly completed and signed. But trouble developed when President McKinley sent the treaty to the United States Senate for approval.
Many Americans opposed the treaty. They thought McKinley was wrong to take the Philippines. Opponents of the treaty included former President Cleveland, industrialist Andrew Carnegie, labor leader Samuel Gompers, writer Mark Twain, and others. They organized anti-imperialist groups in many cities to oppose the treaty. They made speeches and published newspapers explaining their opposition. Imperialism, they said, had ruined ancient Rome, and it would ruin the American Republic. They said colonies halfway around the world would be costly to protect. A large army and navy would be needed. They said colonial policies violated important democratic ideas upon which the United States had been built. We went to war with Spain, they said, to free Cuba from its colonial masters, not to make ourselves masters of the Philippines.
Republican Henry Cabot Lodge of Massachusetts led the Senate fight for the treaty. The opposition was led by the other Massachusetts senator, George Hoar, also a Republican. Senator Lodge appealed to national pride. he urged the Senate not to pull down the American flag. Rejection of the treaty, he said, would dishonor the president and the country. It would show that we are not ready as a nation to enter into great questions of foreign policy. Senator Albert Beveridge of Ohio also spoke in support of the treaty. Senator Beveridge said the Pacific would be of great importance in coming years. Therefore, he said, the power that rules the Pacific will be the power that rules the world. And with the Philippines, that power is and forever will be the United States.
Senator Hoare spoke strongly against the treaty. He said that taking over the Philippines would be a dangerous break with America's past. He said the greatest thing the United States had was its tradition of freedom. To take the Philippines, he said, would deny that tradition. It would violate the Constitution and the ideas contained in the Declaration of Independence, the idea that all men are created equal, and that government exists only with the permission of the governed.
The Senate vote on the treaty was set for February 6th. It seemed that the opposition had enough votes to reject it. But several things happened before the vote. William Jennings Bryan, the leader of the Democratic Party, opposed the takeover of the Philippines. But he urged Democratic senators to vote for the treaty. Bryan was looking ahead to the presidential election in 1900. He believed that the Philippines' takeover would cause the United States nothing but trouble. He could put the blame for all the trouble on the Republicans. Then, if he was elected president, the Democrats could give the Philippines their independence. Bryan succeeded in getting 17 Democrats and populists in the Senate to vote for the treaty.
2 days before the vote was taken, violence broke out in the Philippines. President McKinley, without waiting for the Senate to act, ordered the American military government in Manila to extend its control throughout the Philippines. The leader of the Philippine rebels, Emilio Aquinaldo, opposed the order. Rebel forces prepared to fight. On the night of February 4th, 30,000 rebels attacked American forces around Manila. 60 Americans were killed, and more than 270 were wounded. Rebel losses were much higher.
News of the rebel attack caused some senators to change their minds about the Philippines. Some who had opposed the treaty now agreed with the Washington Star newspaper that the Filipinos must be taught to obey. 84 senators were present for the vote on the treaty. To pass, the treaty needed a two-thirds majority, 56 votes. One by one, the senators voted. Then the count was announced. 57 of the lawmakers had voted yes. Only 27 had voted no. The treaty was approved. The Philippines belonged to the United States.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.